Welcome to Stargate SG-1 for the first time, still not a Star Trek podcast. My name is Jeff Aiken, and I'm watching Stargate SG-1 for the first time.
And I'm Brent Allen, and I'm watching Stargate SG-1 for the 47th time. Jeff and I are two veteran Star Trek podcasters who joined forces to bring you a little show called Babylon 5 for the first time. And we had such a blast doing that show, we decided to do it right here with Stargate SG-1.
So we're giving this show the for the first time treatment. For me, since it's my first time and not Brent's, I'm just going to be watching the show, experiencing it as it happens and unfolds, and you get to come along with me on that journey and relive your first time experience.
It's really the magic of any kind of a for the first time show, is getting to relive vicariously through you that first experience. However, I am not doing it that way. What I am doing, even though I've seen this show 47 times before, for the first time, I'm going to be watching this show with an eye specifically geared towards what is Stargate trying to teach us. You know, those lessons that hold up a mirror to society, give us hope that things can be better in the future, or just teach us how to be better human beings to one another.
Since this is still not a Star Trek podcast, to keep us honest and on track, we play a game called The Rule of Three. The Rule of Three limits us to no more than three references to Star Trek per episode.
That's it. Three. Uno, dos, tres. No substitutions, exchanges, or
And when we do make those references, because we will, you're going to hear this sound.
But you know, there is also the possibility. Nope, I did this again last week. It is the probability. We're going to be making some Babylon 5 references because that's really our current jam over at Babylon 5 for the first time. So when we do that, you're going to hear.
Oh, yes.
All right, Brent. So last week, I made a prediction about the episode we're about to dive into, Brief Candle.
Yep.
And I'm thinking that that prediction was we're going to go to another world and someone's going to fall into a crevasse.
Wait, I'm sorry. Was your prediction we're going to go to another world?
I'm taking a note from you, right? The king of predictions. The one who will be, right? Hey, in the next episode.
You got it right. Five points to Jeff.
They're going to go to a planet and O'Neill's going to be in the episode. That's my prediction. But I figured they're going to go and someone's going to fall into a crevasse, a cave, a something. Air is going to be a problem. And like Brief Candle, the candle's burning out. And they gotta save them. So we'll find out what it really is here shortly. But before we do that, Brent, why don't you lay some facts on us about this episode?
Well, yeah, certainly facts. This is episode 9 of season 1, Brief Candle. Originally aired September 19th, 1997. Jeff, I found out something new about this episode I've never known before. The title and where this title comes from and what this title references. I'm going to tell you what it is. I'm going to give you a chance to rework your prediction.
Eesh.
This title is a Shakespearean reference.
Okay.
From the play Macbeth in Act 5, Scene 5 or something like that.
From the play.
The play.
Yeah, yes. The play.
Yeah, the play. Here we go. It says, this is what it says. All right, I'm going to read this verbatim from the script, and I'll let you see if you can't maybe muster why they would have chosen this as the title, which I'll remind you, sometimes it has absolutely nothing to do with the show. Looking at you, Parliament of Dreams, or whatever happened to Mr. Garibaldi.
Wasn't even in the episode.
Wasn't even in the episode. All right. All right, here it says, out, out, Brief Candle. Life's but a walking shadow, a poor player that struts and frets his hour upon the stage and then is heard no more. 'Tis an old tale told by an idiot, full of sound and fury, signifying nothing.
I know the line. I know that line.
I tried to do that in my best Patrick Stewart impression, and it was better than me just reading it in my normal Brent voice, but still, I don't know that you can get better than Patrick Stewart reading something like that.
Literally the thing. It's like, that's literally the thing he is. Mm-hmm. God, I don't want to make the, I don't know. I could go a lot of different ways. So,
okay. You know what? Don't worry about it. Why don't we get into the episode? We'll talk about it on the backside and see if he can't pick it out from that.
Okay, cool.
With that, let's go ahead and jump into today's episode. If you are joining us for the first time here at Stargate SG-1 for the first time, the way this works is Jeff and I are going to go watch this episode right now. Jeff's never seen it before. We're going to go watch it right now. If you're watching with us on YouTube, you're going to get the reaction video that we put out. If you'd like to see the full unedited version of that reaction, head over to our Patreon page. It's our sort of centralized Patreon page merged in with the other show. So it's patreon.com/Babylon5First. That's the number five, the word first.
And if you're on the audio version of this, you're listening on a podcasting app like Good Pods, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, whatever, you're going to hear a new sound that we just made up. You might actually have it in older episodes also, but we just like now made it.
In production timeline, it's new to us.
Exactly. Might be old to you, but new to us. You're going to whoosh through the gate, and then you're going to come back after we've watched the episode. Don't drop out of this thing, because when we come back, you're going to hear my first time reaction to what happened in the episode, and we're going to hear Brent tackle any of those sci-fi like messages that he may or may not have found in this one. So Brent, let's dive in.
Chevron 7 locked.
Well, SG-1 has just arrived on the island paradise planet of Argos, very much styled after the ancient Greeks. Fortunately, or maybe not so fortunate, a very pregnant local goes into labor just as they step through the gate, and no one else is around to help. Daniel steps in and saves the day, the babe, and the mom, and to honor him and thank him, she and her husband name the baby Danelle. Soon, SG-1 meets the rest of the Argosians. They're welcomed and well-received. A big dinner party is thrown. O'Neill is offered some food served by a very young and beautiful woman, which, according to the basic rules of off-world travel, means that they just got married. That night, Jack and Kynthia, the young woman whom he married, consummate their marriage. Outside the woohoo tent, SG-1 notices something weird. Everyone on Argos lays down wherever they are and goes to sleep. All at the exact same time. Sam suspects it may be something in the food, since O'Neill was the only one to eat their food, and he was the only one to pass out with the rest of them. But the next day, they all wake up. Also, at the exact same time. Weird. Carry on as if it's perfectly normal, and everyone is super well-rested. That morning, they're greeted by the sight of a bouncing toddler. His name is Danelle, too. Oh, wait. No. This is Danelle, who was just born yesterday? That might seem impossible, but it turns out his parents are only a few days old themselves, on the order of like 14 or so. So you see, the Argosians' entire lifespan is only 100 days. They progress through the normal human experience just at a significantly faster rate. The Argosians acknowledge that this isn't much time, which is why they must savor every moment that Pelops gives them. Well, along with a super fast growing baby, O'Neill has begun to age super quick, advancing through his 50s, 60s, even into his 80s in a fairly short fashion. He becomes increasingly crotchety with each passing gray hair. And back in the SGC, Sam and Dr. Fraser check out some of Jack's blood and discover that it's teeming with nanites, which is what's responsible for the quick aging. Turns out old Pelops, the Goa'uld, that brought these people from ancient Greece to Argosia wanted to see what the human race would become. So he sped up their evolutionary process, but I guess he became bored and realized that we wouldn't be ascending anytime soon because he checked out a long time ago. And leaving Sam and the rest of SG-1 to be snookered if they can't figure it out. And Jack looks like he's about to buy the farm from extreme old age. Accepting his fate, Jack takes a walk on the beach with Kynthia, well beyond the city limits. They go far. Very far, watching the sun start to set, and suddenly they realize something. Something weird is happening. They're not asleep yet. That should have happened already. This makes Jack theorize that there must be something, some sort of device, some sort of technology back at the town that triggers the sleep and wake functions. Well, before you can say Pelops is a big old poopy head, SG-1 is back on Argos. They find the device, destroy it, and give us the moral of the story, and tell everyone, including Jack, that they're going to be okay now and live long, normal lives. But no word on if Jack and Kynthia will stay together. I guess we'll just have to wait and see if she ever comes back. All right, Jeff, there you go. That was Brief Candle. What about it?
Those nanocyte things are pretty slick. Not only do they shorten your lifespan, right, to 100 days, it sounds like. But they make you pretty dang good looking, too. So, like, you're going to maximize every single one of those 100 days. It was a fun episode. Like, I enjoyed this. It was cool. We talked a little bit about
Richard Dean Anderson.
Richard Dean Anderson.
Just go with RDA.
RDA. Wow. Wow. I'm going to cut this out of the audio side. I'm just going to say, you know, RDA went through the aging process here, right? And so we got to see Stargate old makeup, and we got to see him, you know, try and sound more and more like an old guy. And it didn't start well. It was a little rough. You could see, like, the, you know, where the skull cap was on his receding hairline a little bit. Mm-hmm. His voice was a little he was trying. But then he got super old, right? Like, he was super old guy, looked good. The makeup was really, I mean, it was clearly makeup, but it was well done. His voice was on point. Like, he's a good old guy. Like, that worked out pretty well. I'm really curious, though, if it's a nanite thing. No one else had a beard. And so his hair grew really long, no beard. I wonder if that's a thing because they make him so attractive, they don't grow a beard. And I feel very self-convicted right there.
I'm just pretty sure you just said I'm better looking than you. So let's.
I did.
I'm for it.
Kind of did. So I think, you know, I had questions around, like, why don't they just take him back to Earth? Why are they leaving and not taking him? But we saw why ultimately. I mean, even without taking him, those nanites got out and went pretty nuts. I think the thing I found most interesting in this episode is that that concept of a Gould having an idea, right? Like, Pelops had this idea. He wanted to see how humanity was going to evolve and grow and what was going to happen, but he didn't want to wait thousands and thousands of years. So let's make a generation 100 days, right, and just cycle through this thing at hyper speed. I wonder what other kind of experiments are out there that Goulds were like. You know, it's almost like the vaults in Fallout, where they make these horrible scenarios and for the people in the vaults, just to, you know, see what people do.
Jeff, I want you to take that thought and just file it in the back of your mind.
Just have it there.
Yep.
So when we were watching the episode,
can I pause you there?
Yes.
Because you're talking about Pelops and what his plan was. This may or may not be the right spot. You tell me, Jeff. How about something new that we'll add in? We're not going to do this every episode, but as it warrants itself through the course of the episode, would you like to know the real Earth history of Pelops?
Yeah.
For whatever it actually really has nothing to do with what happened in this episode. Pelops is from ancient Greek mythology. He is said to be the grandson of Zeus. His father was a guy by the name of Tantalus. Do you know who Tantalus is?
I know the name.
Yeah, so Tantalus, we get the word tantalize. Tantalus was punished by the gods, where he was made to stand in, like, a pool of water that was, like, up to his chin.
Yeah, okay.
And every time he went to go take a drink, the water lowered, and he had, like, some food, like, right by his hand, and every time he reached up to grab it, it would pull out of the way. The reason he was being punished by the gods was because he took his son, Pelops, chopped him up, and fed him to the gods.
Okay.
And the gods didn't know, and they got really mad. They eventually put Pelops back together. Demeter never gave her little piece back, so she gave him, like, some ivory or something like that. But Pelops would go on to, again, you always have to go with the sort of stuff, go, what's real, what's not. He did go on and find the Peloponnesian Islands.
Okay.
Where that name comes from, the Peloponnesian Islands of ancient Greece. And he ruled there. He had a shrine set up to him by Hercules, and he somehow had something to do with the finding of Mount Olympus, and he really did do the chariot thing. So,
okay.
He's kind of a god, a demigod, I guess, more than anything, you know, so could be a Gould, low level Gould for sure.
Wow. That's kind of cool.
Interesting.
Interesting stuff. When we were watching the episode, mm-hmm. we had a little disagreement, and I think we should dive into that if this is a good spot.
I would love to, because it really plays very much into a lot of the messages that I got. But go ahead, Jeff.
I had pointed out, so Jack turns into conspiracy theory old man. Like, he's just sitting on his old chair with pillows around him, and anybody who walks by, he's like, you know, it's all a lie. It's all a lie. Listen to me, kid. Like, and he just becomes that crazy guy, you know? But I made the comment in there. I'm like, here we go again with Jack being like, my way is the right way. I'm not even going to hear yours out. Like, yours sucks. And you got to listen to me because this guy's wrong. And you said, well, he's kind of right. I don't think he is. I don't see a problem. I see a problem with the manipulation that Pelops did and how he's using people or whatever. But if we take that out of the equation and just say, here's a group of people that have a 100-day lifespan, what's wrong with that?
So I would like to push back on that by saying you can't take that out of the equation. That is a part of the equation. Jack knows the truth that it's not just that this is not a situation where these people's lives and culture have developed and it is unique to them. They have been manipulated. And as we even see at the end of the episode, if you take the manipulation away, they're going to live a lot longer than 100 days. They're going to get their thousands of days, and they actually now get a chance to do something. Where I'm kind of with you is Jack recklessly comes in and destroys all of their belief system, which their culture, their values, everything is wrapped around. There is no care being taken there. And if there is something we've learned from Star Trek is if you go in and you just rip that all away, bad stuff can come fill the void. You know, there is a way to go about that. And Jack's being very, very reckless with it. If it was left to itself, if this is just the way that people wanted to live, if it's where they, how life was for them without outside interference of an alien, which, by the way, we know is actually not there for their benefit, but is there to use them, as we've seen with other Gould, then mm-hmm. Yeah, I think Jack's right to try to get that off. Although he did mention, and I've never heard that before in this episode. I've just never heard this line. Teal'c says at one point, he goes, well, maybe it was a good Gould.
Yeah.
And Jack like chokes on the cake going, there's no such thing as a good Gould. I mean, I would come to your side if it was possible that Pelops was a good Gould.
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Before we gate into the rest of this episode, did you know you're missing most of the content from this podcast? Stargate SG-1 For the First Time has an active and exciting Patreon that you can join right now by clicking the link in the show notes. Not only will you get access to the full, unedited podcast and reaction videos, you'll also be able to join a growing, vibrant, maybe even an intergalactic community. Subscribers even get access to all of our content from Babylon 5 for the first time. Don't miss out on this content and the amazing people. Just click the link in the show notes. Teal'c thinks you should do it right now.
Indeed.
I think it is possible, right? So here's
Is it really? Really? Really, Jeff?
Okay, so here's what we know from our time in the Babylon 5 world. We know that manipulation of someone with telepathic powers can result in them turning into a higher being and ascending as a thing. We know that there's a race called the Vorlons that, what we understand of the lore, over time evolved and they became this higher kind of this first, you know, thing. So what Pelops could have been doing was, hey, in your evolutionary roadmap, there's a really cool thing millions of years down the road. I'm going to give it to you in 100 years.
But here's the thing. And this is what maybe I'm just so familiar with. This is where my mind automatically goes. Why would Pelops want to do that though?
Why not? Why wouldn't he? Maybe he's a good Gould.
No. Why would he? Because remember what Pelops actually is as a Gould. He's a parasite.
Oh, so he wants better humans.
So if he can get a more advanced host, if he can build for himself and listen, Pelops is a very in human mythology, he's the grandson of Zeus.
Mm-hmm.
He's not even a demigod. He's like one quarter god at that point. Like he's not anything. He's not that. He's very, very low level. So what happens if he can do something and give himself an advantage over all the other Gould? And I think if you don't realize it now, Jeff, as you get to know the Gould a lot of their motivation is how do we get better for hosts? That they'll have no problem shedding this particular body that they have right now if they
can get into something better.
But again, that may just be my interpretation of knowing the Gould as a whole. So
yeah, because like at this point, I mean, Tilk brings up it might be a good Gould, and I have no reason to think there's not, you know, other than it's a sci-fi show and things tend to be pretty homogenized, you know, as far as like, oh, those are the good guys, those are the bad guys.
The idea that Tilk would even suggest a good Gould being that you know, false gods and all of that, that is an intriguing concept that Tilk would even introduce that idea.
As a first-time viewer, there were questions there.
It's fair.
But I agree that there was manipulation of the people that made this happen, but I feel like there were two ways they could have come at this. There was the way, the anthropological way of, okay, here's what we're dealing with. You got a 100-day life cycle, you got kids, they, you know, they age super fast, all this kind of stuff. Let's understand that and get it. They talk about how, gosh, you live for thousands of days, so you can learn all these things, and then you can teach those things and pass them on. In a real way, reproduction for humans is our form of immortality, right? Like, I can take the things of my life, pass that on to my offspring, who then pass on. And that's not just knowledge. That's in our genetic being, right? Like, there are experiences I'm having now today that leave markers on my genetic code. And when I use that with someone else to create a life, those things pass on. So that's how we persist. Same thing can happen if the lifespan's 100 days.
You know, if I may interject there, I think there is a very natural human thing. The obsession would be the wrong word, but there is a keen interest and a keen awareness of our ancestry.
Yep.
In humanity, because of those people who've gone before us. I mean, listen, my great 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 grandfather. Do you know the amount of blood that I still share with him that's running through my veins right now? It's a very tiny fraction.
Uh-huh.
You know, split between his wife, my great-grandmother, and then their children and that wife, you know, all the way down. It's a very tiny fragment, but still, that's my blood. And the things that guy, like, I can trace my family line all the way back to William the Conqueror crossing the English Channel from the Norman area of France over and taking over England.
Wow.
I can cross it all. I can trace it all the way back there. I feel super connected to that event. That was 1,200 years ago now.
In a very real sense, you were there, because part of the code in your DNA, in your genome, was there.
Yeah.
Like, you know, I mean, you get kind of, you know, woo-woo with some of that stuff, but it's scientifically correct. Like, it's how we do things.
It's also the Lion King.
Yeah.
You know, Simba's lost his dad. He meets Rafiki as an adult, and he's like, yeah, my dad's whatever. And Rafiki's like, no, your father is still alive. Come on, I'll show you. He takes him and shows him a reflection of himself. And he goes through the whole thing, and he says, he lives in you.
Mm-hmm.
He lives in you. And yeah, I got to tell you, I've tried to teach my children that. Like, I am always with you, no matter what happens. I am acutely aware of the idea that I could die at any moment and leave my young children. I'm acutely not that there's anything wrong with me. I just, a car crash or whatever. Like,
yeah, anything.
Yeah, anything could take me out. And I want my children to always know who I am, where I stand, what they mean to me, and to never, ever, ever question my love for them. And for that to spur them on, to know that I'm always with them no matter what. And that's a good thing. Like, that's how I stay alive.
Exactly. And, you know, and then they'll tell stories of you to their kids and on, you know, and that's how we live. And about to transition to the sci-fi messages that you found in this, but this conversation we've just had, and kind of my thought was encapsulated in this one line. What was the girl's name?
Kynthia.
Kynthia says this, and I'm like, I just like, oh my God, this is profound. She says, the time of one heartbeat can become eternity.
Mm.
And so when you think about that, right? Like, we don't know how long we have. And so every heartbeat matters. And what we do in a heartbeat can have ramifications and impacts and ripples through eternity. And so I think just from a philosophical standpoint, 100 years or 100 days is really irrelevant, because none of us know what we have. And so, you know, try and make those heartbeats in eternity. And with that piece, Brent, what other sci-fi messages did you find in Brief Candle?
I don't know that I could answer that question, Jeff, because that was the message.
Oh, sorry. Yoink.
No, it's fine. It's fine. Here's the thing. Jeff, if I were to ask you this question, do you know what I mean when I say it? What are you going to do with your dash?
I do know that. You taught me this.
Have I told you this? Okay. Yeah. So look, here's the deal. You go out to a graveyard, pick a graveyard, any graveyard like, they all do kind of the same thing. Go and look at every headstone. You'll see two dates on there. The day that they were, the year that they were born, the year that they died. In between those two dates is a little dash. That little dash is their life. That's the entirety of their life is all contained in that dash. And the question I think that this show posits is, what will you do with your dash? Jack asked this dude, I forget the guy's name. He said, what would you do if you knew that you had thousands of days to live? And the guy all of a sudden starts dreaming like, oh my gosh, I would do this and I would leave and I would go explore and see what's out there. But I don't have that many days. He understood 100 days is not a lot, you know? So listen, I'm going to cherish every day here and I'm going to make the most that I can of every day here. But if I had thousands of days, oh, I'm going to go do some stuff with it. And then Kenthea comes by when Jack's being old and just sort of sitting there. Now, granted, Jack's trying to figure out what's going on. He's trying to figure out how to extend his life. But really, he was just being cantankerous and old and ornery and all that stuff. And she says this line to him, you do not spend your life, you waste it.
Wow. Yeah, yeah.
You're not spending your life, you're wasting it. She said, we don't have thousands of days, so we have to treasure every moment. Okay, let's bring this to real life. Real life is short. Treasure every day. Sure, we may have thousands of days. You're never guaranteed tomorrow. You're never guaranteed the next. But even 1,000 days, I said earlier, I have 16,000 days and I'd like to have another 16,000. 32,000 days. Guess what? That's a limited amount of days.
Yeah.
That's a finite amount. There's only so many. Spend your days well. Don't waste your days. So I would say that the message of this episode is spend your dash well. Now it's up to me to kind of give this a rating, a Chevron rating of how strong was that message. Some of that strength, as we've often discussed, Jeff, has to do with the intentionality of the writers. What are they really trying to get across? It is the idea of spend your life well, really what they were trying to say, or is this sort of incidental to the overall story? I think it was a little more incidental to the overall story. So that's going to pull at least a chevron or two off, but it's a pretty heady, like they have the, okay, you see now, Timmy, moment between Kenthea and Jack.
Right.
So I'm going to leave this one here with 4 chevrons.
Nice.
4 chevrons.
I like that.
Now, Jeff, while I get to put chevrons on this thing, you get to do the, perhaps the more fun part of this, and you get to add this to our ranking of season 1 episodes. It is our entirely correct, 100% immutable, ironclad ranking of the episodes of season 1 of SG-1. I will read them to you from top to bottom. There's only a handful so far. We've got the Knox sitting in at number 1, Cold Lazarus at number 2, the Broken Divide at number 3. We might want to rethink the immutable, ironclad.
A little bit there, yeah.
We got Children of the Gods, Enemy Within, First Commandment, and Emancipation. Jeff, where do you place Brief Candle?
I love your comment on the Broken Divide, because that's where Jeff puts it, right? Not the fandom. So just, you know, got to own that. It's a first time view. When I look at the ranking, I'm struck by a thing. And that thing I'm struck by is Children of the Gods, smack dab in the middle. And it's fascinating because the 3 episodes above it, I really either enjoyed or felt a lot from. The 3 episodes below it, I could do without, like completely.
Sure.
This is where we're going to kind of break that up a little bit. And so where does Brief Candle go? And when we talk about that immutability of the piece at the point of Broken Divide, that's where it's going to go, right above Broken Divide, and become our new number 3.
All right. Number 3, Brief Candle. Jeff, I got to tell you, Brief Candle is one of those episodes. I mentioned last week that Knox is one of those, like, if I'm ever like just kind of hanging out, trying to go to sleep, whatever, doing laundry, just going to throw an episode on. Brief Candle's one. Let's watch Brief Candle. It's a great episode. I thoroughly enjoy the episode.
Really, honestly, I think some things that took it down a little bit for me, just the initial old man makeup was a little off. I'm super bothered by the fact he didn't grow a beard, and that's a me thing. I'll just have to get over that. But you made a point when we were watching the reaction that, like, all of the Chosen in a heartbeat turned on Pelops. They're just like, hey, this crazy old guy over here is saying stuff, and so now I'm going to throw out my... That was a little contrived and ridiculous in there, but that's not horrible. It's still a super enjoyable episode. I really dug it.
Well, Jeff, that's going to do it here for Brief Candle. Next time, a cool episode. I bet you're never going to have any thoughts about what this one might be. The title of the episode is Thor's Hammer. Jeff, would you care to venture a guess as to what Thor's Hammer might possibly be about? You've never seen this before. You have no idea. I know exactly where this is going. What do you think, Thor's Hammer? What does that bring up for you?
Well, we got Greeks. We got Greek gods. We got Egyptian gods. We're heading to Asgard, right? This is it. We're going to talk Thor and Odin and the whole, like, this is going to be the, will this be the Viking group of people or something like that? And I don't know what's going to happen, but that's going to be the setting. I'm going to make a prediction at least around the setting.
That is a true Brent. I'm going to leave it that vague. Well, we will see you next time right here on Stargate SG-1 for the first time. Thank you guys so much for joining us. Please don't forget to subscribe wherever you get your podcast or right here on YouTube. Make sure you subscribe to us here. Like, share the video, share the podcast with anyone out there that you know that loves SG-1, or share it with somebody who you're trying to get to like SG-1 for the very first time. Lots of people these days coming into SG-1 for the first time,
yeah.
Jeff.
Yeah.
Lots of people. Make sure you guys do that. And that's going to do it for Jeff and I this week. So until next time, thank you guys so much. And
hey,
Hey, Jeff.
Quick question for you. Would you like a piece of this cake that I made?
Oh, for crying out loud!